You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Over 25 people murdered in just over 2.5 years. What was happening in the small coastal town of Santa Cruz between October 1970 and February 1973? John Lindley Fraser's home invasion murders of the Ota family and Dorothy Cadwallader in 1970 and the serial murder sprees of Herbert Mullen and Edmund Kemper left tremors in Santa Cruz that can still be felt today. Local law enforcement, victims' families and friends, classmates and acquaintance of the killers, local historians, voices from the past and present, and the killers themselves all come together to tell the horrific stories and explain why Santa Cruz was dubbed the murder capital of the world in the early 70s. Murder Capital of the World is a primary source history telling the story of Santa Cruz in the early 1970s through quotes and first-person stories. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder, Capital of the World. The Santa Cruz community looks back at the John Lindley Fraser, Herbert Mullen, and Edmund Kemper murder sprees of the early 1970s with my special guest, journalist and author, Emerson Murray. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Emerson Murray.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. First off, as I mentioned beforehand, a very, very impressive package, the entire book, and especially the incredibly astounding photos that you have, which are over 300 in all, in total. Let's start off right away with this, the acknowledgments, where you got this idea and the impetus, and the unique format, and how you came to this book.
Yeah, so I tell people I've really been working on this book for about 30 years. The whole story itself here in Santa Cruz has just been in our family since before I was born. One of my father's good friends, a man named Jim Genera, was murdered by Herbert Mullen just a few months before I was born, actually. And so as we were growing up, and I tell the story in the book, there was always a picture of my dad and Jim hiking on my dad's wall. And it was something that we just always knew. We knew Jim had been murdered by this serial killer. And of course, that term wasn't around at that time, but he had been murdered by this man. And it was just something we talked about. And really, that whole time period was sort of in the air in Santa Cruz, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s when I was young. And I can remember my family being at parties and hearing other adults talking about these crimes and about all the things that went down at that time period. So because Santa Cruz was such a small community, it was just there. It was present.
Now, you mentioned the film The Lost Boys that was filmed in Santa Cruz under the fictional name of Santa Carlo. Explain how the relevance and the importance to this story and your book and The Lost Boys film.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people actually know Santa Cruz just simply from the film The Lost Boys. They know it was filmed here, and when they came and filmed, they changed the name, but Santa Cruz was known as the murder capital of the world at that time. And so in the beginning of the film, as the protagonist and his mom and his older brother are driving into town, they pass by this big billboard, and it says, you know, welcome to Santa Carla and all this. And as they pass by, the camera lingers on the sign, and on the back of the sign, you can see somebody has scrawled this graffiti, murder capital of the world. So they sort of kept our moniker, but I always make the joke that in the movie, they had to deal with a handful of teenage vampires, and we had to deal with an eco-terrorist and a serial killer who was killing people for earthquakes and a psychosexual killer who was murdering teenage hitchhikers. It was like in the movie, they had nothing on us.
Yeah, much stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
Your book also includes modern quotes and historic quotes, meaning back from the 70s when this occurred, 70, 73, but also modern quotes from many people like Herbert Mullen and Edmund Kemper and this Fraser, John Lindley Fraser. Let's get to right away. You talk about a headline. You also talk about the District Attorney Peter Chang in an interview asked if Santa Cruz was murder capital. And he said, right now, we must be the murder capital.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you talked about the format that there's quotes used. So let's talk about the who is quoted, and let's talk about the first headline that you have in the book with the Santa Cruz Sentinel, February 13, 1973. I guess that really talks about this and really identifies what you're saying, that this recognizes that there's something very, very unusual and murderous going on.
Right, yeah. So first of all, let me talk about the newspaper. So, yeah, that was from Tuesday, February 13th, 1973, and that was the day that Herbert Mullen murdered his last victim, and he was caught just minutes later. And it sort of encapsulates what the entire book is about. If you look at this newspaper headline along the top, it says something like, crime spree soars, another murder. And then underneath the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the banner, is a senseless slaying of an old man. And then there's another murder that's unrelated to these three killers, about youth held in a Capitola death, about a young man who killed a woman named Ida Stein in Santa Cruz. And then they're also talking about these bodies that are washing up on the ocean that are found, and rape victims being picked up by hitchhikers. Who are these hitchhikers? And then another kidnapping case and an article about women hitchhikers. It was unbelievable. And this is all from one day. It was just stunning. And it sort of exemplified of what I wanted to talk about in the book. And that is, you know, it was absolute overwhelming chaos for law enforcement and for our community at that time. And you said it right. Peter Chang was being interviewed after four boys were murdered by Herbert Mullen and their bodies were found. He was being interviewed by a San Francisco Examiner reporter, and the reporter was, you know, halfway joking around, you must be the murder capital of the world. And Peter Chang said, yeah, at this time we must be the murder capital. And it just stuck. It stuck to us like glue. You know, our city council, our board of supervisors couldn't stand it. There's records I found in the there's notes in the official records of the transcripts of our supervisor meetings, and they're railing against this. Oh, who gave us this stupid title? It's ridiculous. And stupid's a quote. They use that word. And it just stuck. So when I had read the for using quotes, I had read a book by a man named Rudolph Gray, who wrote a book about the filmmaker Ed Wood, and he had used quotes. This is like in the late 1980s or early 1990s. And I thought, what a great way to tell a very nuanced story, because Ed Wood was a complicated person. And to some people, you know, he was a wacko, and to some people he was, you know, they loved him like a brother. And I thought, God, for something like this, a true crime story where there's a lot of different stories going on, and people are remembering events slightly different, as well as the fact that, you know, we'll say Edmund Kemper, he's alone with a victim at night, and what happened to that victim and what he did, only he knows. Nobody knows. You know, maybe we may have some CSI information from the crime scene, but it really went down the way that he said it. So, rather than come in like a heavy-handed author and say, this is what happened here, this is what happened here, this is what happened here, I really wanted to get a well-rounded picture of everyone's point of view. And, you know, we're talking to the old hippies, we're talking to the old law enforcement, we're talking to everyone to sort of get this picture of what Santa Cruz was like at that time. And I talked to well over 100 people, and I grabbed quotes from every source. I think I make a joke in the book, you know, I stole and robbed them from every source I could find, from every newspaper, just trying to get a picture, you know, what was going on back then. So, yeah, we jump around, and I put the year there. So you can see Edmund Kemper telling his story in the 1970s, right after he got caught. this happened, this happened. And then you can see him again in 1991 at a parole hearing, and his story changes slightly. And then in 2017 again at another parole hearing, and his story changes drastically. And what did he have to lose and gain all along the way when he's telling these different stories in different ways? And why is the story one way? Well, it may have something to do with his defense attorney just filed the insanity plea. So it's just, for me, I found it a great way to tell a story on many, many layers.
Absolutely. It's very, very, very effective. One of the three people featured in this book are John Lindley Fraser, Herbert William Mullen, and Edmund Kemper III. Herbert William Mullen and Edmund Kemper, people know the basic stories, and we'll get you to just outline them as you do, just the very basic ones. But very interestingly, this John Lindley Fraser is not as well known, yet when you include very early on in the book the great iconic or infamous half-and-half photo. So before we talk about John Lindley Fraser, tell us about this very dramatic photo that you have, the half-and-half photo.
Yeah, that's like one of the most important pictures, and like it has to be in the book. Yeah, so John Lindley Fraser was, and his attorneys, the public defenders, they had were just going into the insanity phase of the trial to see if he was insane or not. So John Lindley Fraser shows up to court, and he before, you know, had long hair and a beard, but he walks into court, and half of his head is shaved from left to right. And his head's bald, and his eyebrows are gone, and his beard and his mustache are gone. And he just presents this stark image. And, of course, you know, the public defender's office, and they're quoted in there saying, what the heck is he doing? You know, like that doesn't prove anything. And what kind of law enforcement would give him a razor in prison or in jail to even do this? So, it's a very stark image. And I can get into John Lindley Fraser. Would you talk about that story? Do you think?
Yeah, tell us basically for people who don't know, and I wasn't so aware of him at all. Tell us basically outline of the murders he was convicted of and committed.
Okay. So the Oda family was what they always say, sort of quote unquote a prominent family in Santa Cruz. And I always wondered, what exactly does that mean? So in doing my research, I learned Dr. Oda was an eye surgeon. And not only was he a very accomplished eye surgeon, but he did a lot of surgeries for free. And he helped out people in the community that couldn't necessarily afford some of his work. His wife was Virginia Oda, was very involved in the community, and she's actually, if you look at old newspapers, she's in the newspaper much more than he ever was, on functions and volunteer work and things like that. They had four children, two sons and two daughters. And in 1970, his two daughters were away at school. One was in Monterey, California, and one was in a design school in New York. The two sons were living at home. Dr. Oda also had an assistant named Dorothy Cadwallader, and she really took care of the kids, and she was really a part of the family. Well, John Lindley Fraser was another local. He was from the Santa Cruz area, and he began having these delusions that he was going to start an environmental movement, and how much he was inspired by the Manson killings in the late 1960s, or even the McDonald killing, where the gentleman at Fort Bragg, was accused of killing his wife and kids. He said a hippie cult came in and did it. So not exactly sure how much he was influenced by that, but he was started to have these delusions that he was going to start an environmental movement where he would go to these rich people's houses, these pigs, as he called them, and rednecks, as he called them, and convince them to burn down their house. And then they would join his group, and they would march to the next rich person's house and burn down their house. And he would just start this global movement and have this brigade, this squad or this army. So he lived not far from the Oda house, which was a prominent, beautiful, beautiful house designed by an architect named Aaron Green, who was a protege of Frank Lloyd Wright. So they built it up on this hill, and Aaron Green was very careful to work with the Oda family, not to even cut down a single tree when they're building the house. And actually, even today, the house is built around trees, you know. But Fraser right. didn't see it that way. He saw it as they were polluting the environment. We're going to burn down this house. So on October 19, 1970, he basically ambushed the family in the house. He killed each member of the family and Dorothy Cadwalader in a terrible, terrible fashion, and left this surreal note, almost sort of like a Zodiac type note, with tarot codes and all these things, as if this was this massive movement and not one man. And he was captured very shortly after because he had been spouting off all of these ideas to his friends and neighbors. So within a couple of days, he was caught for those murders. But you know, the flood, the press descended on Santa Cruz, and this made headlines all over the world. The one of the district attorneys was actually in Africa, and he saw a newspaper, and there it was in the headlines on Africa. He's in Africa, and he said, "Oh my goodness, wow. I better go home." So that. And then, as you talked about before, hot on the heels of that, right after the trial, both Herbert Mullen and Edmund Kemper started their murder sprees.
Right. And people know that Herbert William Mullen, between October 72 and 73, you're right, he murdered 13, apparently after yeah. the death of his best friend and excessive use of hallucinogenic drugs. Of course, he showed signs of mental illness and soon began killing. He stated that he believed the murders could prevent earthquakes. Edmund
yeah.
Kemper III is more well-known. Tell us a little bit about Edmund Kemper, because he did a lot of talking. And according to your book as well, John Douglas and Robert K. Ressler, when they decided to do their impromptu visits to the prisons to speak to serial killers, or before that term was even coined, the first person that they spoke to was Edmund Kemper. So he was very cooperative
yeah, exactly.
in trying to have some insights into exactly how he became.
Yeah. So very quickly, Edmund Kemper, when he was 15 years old, he had murdered his grandparents. He desperately wanted to live with his father. He lived with his mother, who I'm sure most of your listeners know was very abusive, or somewhat abusive. She shipped him, or he ran away from home to live with his father. His father shipped him off to his parents in this very remote area of California. He ended up killing his grandparents, and he was sent to the CYA, the California Youth Authority, and then also to Atascadero, which was sort of a mental hospital. And he had stated a couple of times, that at Atascadero, you know, as a young man, he saw that the hospital was full of rapists that had been caught. And so he started to formulate these ideas that, well, I want to do that and I will not be caught. So he started working on his ideas. I always think of Edmund Kemper as almost like a hunter of people. He was a very clever man, very intelligent man who knew law enforcement, knew the techniques, and really practiced. So anyway, he gets out of Atascadero, the mental hospital. They tell the CYA, you know, whatever you do, do not release him to the custody of his mother, because she's sort of the triggering factor in his violence. So in their infinite wisdom, the CYA releases him to the custody of his mother, and he goes to live with her in Santa Cruz, California. So very shortly after, Edmund Kemper starts picking up hitchhikers and sort of perfecting his plans. You know, by his own account, he picked up hundreds of hitchhikers and dropped them off safely right where they wanted to go. But in his mind, he starts planning, what clothes am I going to wear? What glasses am I going to wear that make me look less intimidating? He starts developing little techniques by, like, looking at his watch when he's picking, I don't know if I have time to take you where you need to go. I guess so, get in.
Wow.
He starts designing even his car. His car had these pull handles, and he could drop a chapstick or a broken-off door handle in it, and the hitchhiker would effectively be locked in with him. And, of course, you know, he's 6'9". He's got a pistol. He's got a knife. and they're not going to be able to stop him. So he started formulating all of these ideas, and I would say a few months, or more than that, several months later, he started enacting his plan, and he killed a total of 6 hitchhikers in the Santa Cruz area. The first 3 he had picked up in the Berkeley area, but he ultimately brought their bodies to Santa Cruz. And that's when, you know, at the almost the simultaneous time, like you said, Herbert Mullen, who had experienced this tragic loss of his friend and started experimenting with drugs, sort of went over the edge and started having these ideations in his head about, I'm going to save California from this massive earthquake and falling into the ocean, and that the Aztecs had it right. It really, the only way we can do this is through human sacrifice, and I guess I will be that person that saves California. I will be that sadist, as he said. So he started killing people. He picked up a hitchhiker as well, but almost simultaneously with Edmund Kemper, and that's where sort of the impact on the community really started to get felt. You know, everyone was breathing the sigh of relief after the Frazier crimes, and here we go again. Bodies start washing up in the oceans. They start finding heads out in the wilderness, and people are being killed.
Now, in the media, and you say this attracted worldwide attention, so you talk about Santa Cruz being a lumber and fishing town, and Peter Chang says you go from a crowded metropolis to a deserted forest in about 3 minutes, and that's why you have things happen here that don't happen anywhere else. Tell us more about Santa Cruz. You talk about the phenomena of hitchhiking and its contribution, but just Santa Cruz in general at this time and its effect from, again, this murder capital of the world tag.
Yeah, sure. So Santa Cruz, you know, it had been for many, many years sort of a sleepy retirement community. Sure, there were surfers here and things like that because the beach is so beautiful, but mostly, there was this conservative retirement community, you know, like you said, fishermen, lumberjacks, you know, we had logging up in the mountains. And in 1965, the University of California at Santa Cruz was opened up on the hill in Santa Cruz. And that brought in just a flood of youth and new ideas, and society just started changing. So that was 65. And as the 60s roll on, you have the anti-war movement, you have women's movements, you have all, you know, drugs start coming into the community. So the community started to go, I mean, if I say it went to war with itself, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much. It became a very hot place. And they actually performed a study at that time about this, what they called an undesirable transient element, the Utes, and who are these Utes. And so the Board of Supervisors paid this company. The company came in, and they were hoping they were going to say, oh, yeah, there's homeless people and drugs and all this. And the study came back with 2 big findings. One, Santa Cruz was very unique in the state of California in that it had a massive population of elderly and older people and a massive population of young and youth, and not a large population of middle-aged people. And so it was creating this conflict within itself. And also, hey, yes, there's a lot of hippies, drugs are coming in, but these people are, number one, they're mostly just smoking dope. They're not, you know, the people that are doing hard drugs are look more like you and me, this is them talking to the Board of Supervisors, than these hippies. And number two, they move on. The hippies move on. And number three, a lot of them that are staying, they're your kids. They're not coming in from the outside. They're your kids. So, of course, needless to say, the Board of Supervisors hated the report. They refuted the report. But that's what it was like here. It was just a hot, tense place. You know, my father, he was a big hippie in the valley, and he had a bus. You can see it at the beginning of the Monterey Pop documentary. You can see my dad in there in his big hippie bus. Oh, yeah. Well, the local fire department tried to firebomb it. They threw Molotov cocktails at it. And so people were getting beaten up. And the idea of hippies, you know, which maybe in the early 60s or as it was formulating, oh, peace and love, you know, by the time of the Manson killings, by the time of the McDonald murders, by the time, you know, it was sort of the notion of it was headed south. And this peace and love was turning into something dark. So we've dealt with that in Santa Cruz. There was also a change in the welfare laws here where you didn't have to live in the community that you got your check. And so it just made Santa Cruz and the whole state of California a little more transient or transitory, where people were moving around and had the freedom to move around. So you had all of these elements sort of stacked on top of each other. And then these crimes start happening and the fingers start pointing.
You have a very interesting way of telling the stories, as you mentioned, with this source element or source document. And then quotes from people important to the story, and very much that's demonstrative in the Oda family and Dorothy Cadwalader murders. You have quotes from Lark Oda. You have quotes from a person named Harold Cartwright. You have the psychologist and expert witness for the defense, David Marlowe. You have Donald Lund. Tell us just a little bit of some of these people's quotes or any example of some of these quotes, because they were so important, all of them, to tell the story of this John Lindley Fraser.
Yeah, I'll tell you about Lark Oda. Lark Oda ended up, she is the sole survivor of the Oda family. Her sister ended up committing suicide a few years after the murders. She just, you know, and directly blamed the murders. Dr. Oda's mother committed suicide after the murders. So Lark has for a very long time been the sole survivor. And I wrote Lark a letter and reached out to her. It was right at the 50th anniversary of the murders in 2020. And I was shocked because there was nothing in our local newspapers about the murders. Here was the 50th anniversary, and they had always done every 10 years a story because it was so impactful. And I thought to myself, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Does this mean that we're healing, or does this mean that we're forgetting? And so I reached out. I always had intended to reach out to Lark, but sort of that was the trigger was, wow, this is interesting. And she was gracious enough to call me back, and we ended up talking for many, many hours about her family and about Santa Cruz in general. She doesn't have a complete awareness of the crime. She has self-censored herself in a very, what I would call a very healthy way. So she doesn't have a lot of details. In fact, I actually made a one-off book. I had one printed at one of those print-on-demands where I cut out all the pages regarding that particular crime just for her. So there's a murder capital of the world, like one-off edition, just the Lark Oda edition for her. But she was what I would call a partner. She was a great partner in it. And her quotes really give you an in-depth look into that family and who they were as people. And really, Dan, that was like my goal. That was, I really want this book to tell the story of the victims and who are the victims and what happened to the community and that, rather than, you know, sometimes you get the books that are sort of serial killer as rock star, and I just didn't want to do that with this. Yeah. I wanted something completely different, you know?
Yes, and a lot of people talk about, you know, talking and focusing on the victims, but you very much do, and especially the photo array, the best photo selection I've seen on people that have passed away. It's very, it's much an honor for these people in terms of at least the dignity-wise, the portrayal in this book and the attention.
I really appreciate you saying that. I do, because I never knew when I was reaching out to the families, you know, exactly how. I always sent a letter first when I was dealing with the families. If it was somebody professionally involved with the case, I felt comfortable calling them. But if it was, you know, like family, and some of them, you know, were like, how dare you even contact, or, you know, that. But like I want to say it was Mullen's second victim. I reached out to her family, and they were just gracious. They sent me pictures, and they were so kind. Her name is Mary Guilfoyle, and there's the only person left that I could find at the time was her brother's wife, so it would be her sister-in-law. And she sent pictures, and she told me, thank you so much for doing this, because we've seen books about the killer, we've seen movies or documentaries about the killer, and no one has ever talked about Mary or asked us or contacted us about Mary. And so for me, that was like, oh, that's like a badge of honor. I was very proud. And sure enough, that she's got a chapter. We've got pictures nobody's ever seen before. And her life was very interesting. You know, she was born in a taxi cab and had heart surgery when she was like 6 years old. She was in medical textbooks. She skipped a grade and she was in New York. This is all in New York. She came out to Santa Cruz, and strangely, no one is alive that remembers exactly why she came to Santa Cruz, like how that connection was made, but she ended up here. And then Herbert Mullen was driving in front of Cabrillo College, and he saw a car in front of it, and it belonged to a man named Ray Liebenberg, who was sort of a local character here. Even I can remember Ray Liebenberg. And Mullen heard in his head Ray Liebenberg's voice, and it said, oh, you're going to need to kill someone for me. And Mullen, you know, being a good soldier, said, oh, yes, sir. So the next day, he's driving in front of Cabrillo College in this exact same spot, and who's standing out? The car's not there, but who's standing out there with her thumb out? It was Mary Guilfoyle. And unfortunately, Mullen picked her up, killed her immediately, and he even said, like, oh, she was a willing participant. She agreed to be sacrificed, and I knew that because after I had stabbed her in the heart, rather than get blood on my seat, she ducked down under the dashboard on the floor of the car, and that was, to him, was a sign that she was a willing participant in her own death, which, of course, is absolutely sick, but, yeah.
That's the mindset, yes. This is an opportunity, Emerson, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. If you're a business owner, it can be tough to hire top talent for your team, especially when you're competing with other businesses to find the right people. So how can you get the hiring edge? ZipRecruiter. Their invite to apply feature lets you invite the best candidates to apply for your open roles. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. How does invite to apply work? When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, you start getting the most qualified people sent to you pretty quickly. Then you can easily review recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply with one click. Next Key marketing manager Erin Harchie loves invite to apply. She says, they get my job posting in front of the right people. I instantly see great candidates, and I can invite them to apply to my job. In fact, according to ZipRecruiter internal data, on average for 2020, jobs where employers use ZipRecruiter's invite to apply get 2.5 times more candidates, which helps make for a faster hiring process. Take it from Erin, who says you can basically tell ZipRecruiter who you need, when you need it, and they deliver. See for yourself. Just go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER, to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we're just talking, Emerson, about Herbert Mullen and the catalyst or the impetus for him to go on his murderous spree. You also, when we talked about John Lindsay Fraser, you also had, interestingly, quotes from his mother, Pat Pascal, from the time, 1970. Again, what are the kinds of things and the information that she imparted that you've included as part of this book?
Yeah, so Pat Pascal was an interesting character. She was another sort of local character. She ran a bunny ranch, which I think was called Bunny Haven. And it sounds cute and fun and everything, and she would show off her bunnies at local fairs and around the state and in competitions and things like that. But she was actually interviewed by our local newspaper, and it's sort of funny. She's talking about bunnies, and it's great. And then at the bottom, there's a little excerpt, and it's a recipe for rabbit leg stew that she had written. So it's like not, it wasn't all fun and games. You know, she was also breeding the rabbits for food. So she, the information that I got, the interviews with her were from, I believe it was the district attorney's office or from the public defender's office. I can't remember off the top of my head, but she went, in depth on Frazier's childhood and his upbringing. He was very sickly as a child. He was born in New Mexico. The father really did not have anything to do with the picture. And he was just in and out of hospitals constantly through his youth and getting misdiagnosed and just very unhealthy troubles. And he always said that she sort of treated him like a friend as he was growing up and not really as a mom. So he started getting in trouble very early on. They moved to California, I think, when he was in junior high or middle school. He started getting in trouble at school. He ended up running away from home. They put him in foster care, and he stole a gun from his foster father. And then he was sent down to like an aunt or a grandparent, I can't remember, down in Southern California, where he got in even more trouble. So he gets sent back up here. And it wasn't until he met his wife that he started to settle down. And they moved up to up into north, I think it was Portland or to Oregon, and really started making a go of it and working. He became an auto mechanic, and a very successful auto mechanic. I mean, he was well known as being a good auto mechanic, very proficient. And then he also started having mental health issues, where becoming more paranoid and things like that. And then he actually was in a car accident, which, strangely enough, is about a mile from where I'm sitting right now, where I live, and supposedly had a head injury, and the police report doesn't bear that out, but he went home from that automobile accident, which really shook him up, and just started ranting to his wife and their roommate that was living with them about, you know, nature and man, and he was never going to drive another car, and that's where he really started down that path of, as I was explaining earlier, of this idea that, hey, we got to get rid of these pigs and these, what he called rednecks, that were polluting the land and destroying nature and get back to nature. And he had a Bible he would edit and cross out ideas. And his mother had this property. His mother is the one that lived near the Oda family, and he later went to go live with her in a little milk barn, but she also had a water tower, and he'd sit up on top of the water tower and meditate because he was afraid of these invisible enemies that were going to try to crawl up the water tower. And he just had a lot of mental health issues that sort of went undiagnosed. And I think he was in a culture. He was not really in the hippie culture, but he was around that culture where a lot of people were doing drugs. And I think a lot of the issues that he had were sort of mistaken possibly for being drug related, when really they were mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the September 9th, 1972, and Herbert Mullen. His parents are away, you write, and he has an intense LSD high or an intense trip. And then he writes and draws in journals all night. Tell us what happens after, or shortly after.
So he had just moved back into the area from San Francisco, and he had actually gotten those drugs from Jim Gennara, who was his high school friend. And that is when he really started to lose it. While his parents were on vacation, he moved back into the house, or he was staying in the house, and then they came back and he agreed. And he that's when he really started imagining, that the Aztecs were right and that we have to do this and I have to make my family proud. And he started hearing his mother and his father's voices. And just days later, roughly a month later, on Friday, October 13th, 1972, he was leaving the house in Felton he was going to return a book to the library, to the San Francisco Library, and ironically, the book was Einstein on Peace. and he's driving, and he sees a man walking alongside the road. And this is a very rural road out in the forest, the redwood forests. And the man was a man named Lawrence Whitey White, and he was a known homeless person in the area. Herbert Mullen passed Whitey. He turned around, drove out in front of Whitey and pulled over his car and acted like he was having car troubles. Mr. White went out to help him and say, "Hey, you need some help?" And while he was looking under the hood, Mullen murdered him with a baseball bat and dragged his body off. And that was Herbert Mullen's first victim was Lawrence White. And that actually was not discovered. They did not discover that he had killed Lawrence White until the trial began. And he admitted that crime as well as the second crime, which was the Mary Guilfoyle one. They were not aware that those were Herbert Mullen crimes until the trial.
You write about briefly about the trials as well and offer quotes about Herbert Mullen's trial. What quotes stuck out most dramatically and importantly from the trial, Herbert Mullen's?
Well, yeah, in Herbert Mullen's trial, that was really where it was, to the public and to everyone else, that is when it came out what his belief system was and what he was thinking, what was going on in his head. Because you have to remember that his crimes were so random. Even for us, like when we were kids, we knew Herbert Mullen logically. We knew he was in prison. But he was still sort of like a boogeyman to us. Because he killed men, he killed women, he killed children, he killed a priest right outside his own confessional. And and so that, for me, is, you know, like if you're not a female and you're not hitchhiking, you know, Edmund Kemper, you're never going to run across him in any kind of violent way. So, but with Herbert Mullen, it was random. And I think that was really what struck so much fear in Santa Cruz was, you know, what is going on here? Who's killing these children? Who's killing... you know, these people, you know, it's a homeless man over here, and then somebody that was selling drugs over here, and then these four boys that were out camping. And so when it hits the trial and Mullen actually took the stand for himself, everybody was just completely blown away by these ideas that he's talking about and these rants that he's going on. I think the jury knew this, he had mental health issues. He may not have been insane by the definition of the law, according to the Manhattan standard, but he clearly had mental health issues. He was not not fit. He was not mentally healthy in any way.
No, he's not faking it, certainly.
Quite
a bit of this book has Edmund Kemper, like I mentioned, he likes to talk, and you have him quoted from 73, 81, 1984, and 1991, with variations in stories, as you say, but also just more elaboration and some other specifics that he didn't go into in 73 that he may have done in the future. There is some incredible stuff about this 9 days after murdering this ACO coup. Kemper gets engaged to his girlfriend. Tell us a little bit about some of the stuff you have included about Kemper.
Yes, sir. So a lot of in the more modern quotes were taken from parole transcripts. And like you said, he doesn't stop talking. So if you can go on YouTube and find interviews with him, you know, from 1991 and various interviews. And I think one of the videos was even recorded by John Douglas and the FBI for a presentation they were giving. But a lot of the earlier quotes were taken from interviews that I had discovered from the public defender's office and with a psychologist that he met with Lundy, Dr. Lundy, Donald T. Lundy. And so a lot of them were very early on, right after he had been caught, and even transcripts from Pueblo, Colorado, right after he turned himself in and they traveled out there to interview him. So these are the first time he's opening his mouth and sort of it just comes flooding out. You know, he's gushing out with all of this because he loves to talk and he wants to talk about himself. So finally he can do so. It got to the point actually where he was held in jail. They're getting ready for the trial, and he keeps calling into the district attorney's office to tell them more and to tell them more and tell them another story and tell them another story. They finally had to call the public defender's office and say, look, you got to get this guy to stop calling us. This is wholly inappropriate. So they just could not get him to stop talking. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, John Douglas and Robert Ressler went out and, you know, you want to get started on an interviewing serial killers, man. Here's a guy that's going to go in depth, remembers every single detail, you know, down to the socks people were wearing, you know, every single detail. And you can't get him to stop. You can't get him to stop talking. So I don't remember what your original question was.
Well, just some of the things that I wanted you to expound upon for sure. It was interesting too when he talked about the one victim, Aku, I believe, decapitated and put in the backyard of his mom's place, and he confessed to that. You feature many victims, like I say, and then it's a much more respectful treatment than you would expect to see in any true crime book. You talk about this Cynthia. You write about Cynthia Shaw, and you have people like Forrest Shaw being able to talk, and some of the things that Cynthia Shaw had said. So, tell us about this story, and what was some of the profound things that you quote.
Okay, great. Yeah, so Cynthia Shaw, yeah, she was actually another Cabrillo College student like Mary Guilfoyle. When Edmund Kemper picked her up, she was actually over at the university, near the University of California, Santa Cruz, on the other side of town. But she was known in the community. She was a babysitter, and she actually was a babysitter for some of the local police. You know, I interviewed Forrest Shaw. That was her brother. And they, you know, he admitted, and we talked about it, that they had a very kind of a rough upbringing. With their mom was rough on them and everything. But, Cynthia Shaw, she was picked up by Edmund Kemper. She was driven out to a remote area. And, you know, he used his line, oh, I'm feeling suicidal, and I just really want someone to talk to, but my neighbors are going to see you, and I can't have that happen. Will you get in the trunk? She got in the trunk. He shot her dead right there in the trunk. And he described it as like sort of the lights going out. She didn't move, didn't flinch, like hardly anything. She just passed away. And then, you know, Kemper did what he did with many of his victims, dissected her body, and hers was the head that he had buried in his backyard for, you know, that, again, he tells the story different ways for why he did it, whether she's looking up at his mother, or whether, you know, he likes the idea of her head being back there, or whether he was simply doing it for identification purposes. He tells different stories at different times. So, but anyway, he drives her body south down to Monterey, and it's been cut up, and he throws it in the ocean, and he drives back to Santa Cruz. Well, within a day or two, he clearly didn't look at the tides and how the tides work. The body washes up on the beaches of Santa Cruz. The body parts start washing up on the beaches of Santa Cruz. So, and of course, that's another one for the newspapers, where they're all over it. A torso washes up, an arm washes up, a leg washes up on the beaches of Santa Cruz. It's just shocking, shocking crimes. And she has been, you know, missing. She had been missing for a couple of days. And I was lucky enough with Cynthia Shaw's case to have Forrest, and Forrest was very open about it. Her brother. I also found some old records where the sheriff's department had interviewed the gentleman she was living with, and she was babysitting his kids, taking care of his kids, and you know, he had certainly had a perspective of her. Oh, she's drug free and all this other stuff. And then they interview her friends, and they're like, oh, she was on drugs a lot and was hitchhiking a lot and stuff. So there again, you get to see sort of the multifaceted angles of somebody. But yeah, a very bright girl, a very, very loved person, and her death was very, obviously very impactful to the community, just because of the grisly nature that, you know, that the incidents that happened after she passed away.
Right. Let's stop for this commercial break for a second. Now, we're talking about Edmund Kemper more, and one of the most fascinating, profound things in your book is a really dapper photo of Edmund Kemper smoking a cigarette, I guess awaiting trial, it looks like, and again, very dapper, very stylish, I don't know, movie star looks, I guess, I don't know, I can't go
yeah.
that far, but anyway, when you write in this time that Edmund Kemper says he explains his murderous bent, and he says part of it was fear, some of it was regret, other parts of it were the opportunities. I didn't just rush out and look for the opportunities. If you'll notice, there was a greater time span between the first and second and the second and third, and there was, and then there was anywhere else. But he decides that he didn't want, blood was not an actual plan in, that the sea blood was, it got in his way. What he really wanted, what he's interested in doing, is seeing the death and having that power. Can you explain more about this quote that I'm talking about, this long thing that
yeah.
Kemper says?
Yeah, so it's an interesting quote because it's a little different than some of the other explanations he gives and things. You know, I forgot who it was, Willie Sutton, who said, you know, I rob bank. Why do I rob banks? It's because that's where the money is. And he had said sort of something about, you know, college students and all these beautiful college students and upper middle class. He wasn't attracted to hippie types. Honestly, I think, you know, after all this research that he really was like a psychosexual killer. He, you know, if that's even a term,
yeah.
I'm just saying that, but he was like a sexual killer in that the power, he was somebody that was bullied most of his life. He was somebody that was, never stood up for himself. And the simply the power and the sexuality of it all. Blood wasn't an issue. His first two victims, he used a knife, and he didn't after that. After that, you know, he strangled Ikoku, and then he started with firearms and very quick deaths, not, you know, no torture or anything like that, anything horrendous, as if murder's not horrendous, but anything more horrendous, I should say, happened after the victims had passed away. And so... yeah, that quote is an interesting one because he's candid, but he's also nuanced. He doesn't forget that, you know, oftentimes the fights, or he would have fights with his mother. They both drank a lot, and they would get in these terrible fights, and then he would go out hunting as a way to release himself, you know, and to get over it. He also said, I had bought a new pistol. In one case, and he was excited to try out this pistol. And so, you know, a woman has to lose her life because Edmund Kemper bought a new pistol. So, you know, it's even the reasons, I think, are multifaceted. So it's not just in those cases, I wouldn't say always changing his story. You know, there's a variety of reasons of why he's going out and doing that. There's not one simple explanation like some people want to believe. It just isn't so.
Yeah, he writes that what he wanted to see was the death, and he wanted to see the triumph, the exaltation
yeah.
of the death. He said it was like eating or a narcotic, something that drove me more and more and more.
Yeah, he even talked about opening his trunk after he had killed someone and looking, and he felt like a hunter, you know, like, I had bagged this thing, you know. And with the early victims, he took Polaroids as if he had propped up their bodies, like he was some sort of hunter, and this was, you know, it's just, it's unbelievable, really.
Yeah. Yeah. You provide the Pueblo, Colorado, April 24, 1973, when Kemper calls Santa Cruz Police Department and asks to talk to Lieutenant Scherer, the lead investigator on related co-ed murders. You provide this amazing telephone transcript, very, very interesting and amazing. Just tell us a little bit about that transcript.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, so I had all my life I had heard about this call. You know, we had always heard, oh, he called in and they didn't believe him. They didn't believe him because he had gone to a place called the Jury Room, which was a bar. I think a lot of your listeners will know this. And he had hung out with law enforcement, with police and deputies in the jury room and sort of, you know, listening in, what's going on with these crimes, what's going on, where are you guys at with these things. But he was also just attracted to power. He was attracted. He wanted, you know, wanted to be. And when we were kids, we always heard, oh, he was too tall. Well, he wasn't too tall. It was, he may have been, but really it was, he had killed his grandparents. You can't be a member of law enforcement after something like that back then. So,
sure.
Anyway, so he had, he knew these people, and it took me a while to find a local law enforcement person that would say, yeah, I hung out with Ed Kemper, but I found a couple of them. A gentleman named Dave Alcorn said, Kemper was kind of annoying, but I liked hanging out with him because he was 6'9", but I could beat him in arm wrestling, which I thought was sort of funny. So Kemper knows these guys. And sure enough, when he goes out to Pueblo, he kills his mother, he kills her friend, drives out to Pueblo, Colorado. He had actually driven past and come back, but he calls in, and sure enough, he knows the guy there, Ed Connor, and Ed was somebody that he had hung out with in the jury room, and we had just heard these stories all my life about, you know, they wouldn't believe him and whatever, and sure enough, when I talked to Ed, he said, yeah, I had a tough time believing. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know him. You know, even before I was a police officer, I had been delivering tires. I worked at a tire place, and he worked at a gas station. So I knew Ed. We visited all the time. And so he's telling me he's the co-ed killer, and he had killed his grandparents. It was just sort of mind-blowing. And to actually find the transcript, there it is. Like, holy Toledo. It was sort of like a gold mine after hearing about this for so long. And the Chuck Shearer thing was sort of interesting. Kemper had this idea that everybody was after him, and they had this big posses formed and big investigations, and they were all after him. Well, nobody on the law enforcement side had a clue. They just didn't know, and that was sort of interesting. When I went into the book, I thought, oh, this is going to be a hard-boiled detective thing, and I'm going to really write about what they were doing. Well, when I talked to Mickey Alufi, who was a deputy sheriff and really a big part of the Kemper investigation, Mickey said, we didn't have any idea. We didn't, you know, these killings were happening over here. The victim types were all different. We were confident. We thought there were two killers, but, you know, they just weren't on it. And with technology and everything, the times, in such a small department, they didn't have a chance. So I quickly got rid of that idea for the book. It's not going to be that. And that was Kemper and Pueblo. That was quite a find. That's pretty. It just blew my mind reading that for the first time.
Absolutely, me too. You talk about the Mullen trial in August 73, and you write about the Kemper trial in November 73, and offer some dramatic and profound quotes. You also have a chapter per se, a prison life and parole hearings, and it seems like there's some artwork there. Why include this? What did you want to convey with this little bit of information?
Yeah, so I did one chapter which was an aftermath for Santa Cruz and where we were at and where the different players and the people that had been in the story, how they were doing and what they went on to do. You know, the people that were still alive and just how they were impacted. But I thought it would be sort of important to also follow these gentlemen because, and I use that term loosely, because at the time the death penalty was taken off the table. So all three of them ended up with life with the possibility of parole. So Mullen just was up for parole in March. Of course it was denied. Frazier went up for parole. He didn't really attend his parole hearings, but in one case, I think he stood out in the hallway and was yelling in at the parole board. But he ultimately committed suicide in prison, in Mule Creek Prison in 2009, and August 13th, I think it was. They went on to have these long lives, and Mullen is still alive. You can see some of the artwork in the book. that he's still doing. Kemper, a lot of people know. You know, he started reading books on tape for the blind for a program. He started making pottery and cups and bowls and things like that. I also thought it was important to catch up with their parole hearings to see how their stories had changed over the years, where Kemper suddenly said, I was not a cannibal, I never ate anybody, and sort of changed his story on that. Strangely enough, just last weekend, we're recording this on Friday, last weekend I went to Mule Creek Prison and met Herbert Mullen,
wow,
which was quite a cleansing. I had been afraid of this man my entire life, and he had killed my dad's friend, and just hearing about it from my dad, and my dad was a big guy, you know, just a big tough guy, and to hear my dad talk about him in those kind of scary terms was, you know, as a kid you're just impacted by that. And so to go and meet this little old man in Mule Creek just felt, you know, it was just, I guess a cleansing is the only real word for it. But it was like, he's still there, and he, there he shall remain until he dies. It's just interesting. I had never been in a prison before.
Wow. That's a whole program talking about that visit, I'm sure. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about this murder capital of the world. The Santa Cruz community looks back at the John Lindley Fraser, Herbert Mullen, and Edmund Kemper murder sprees of the early 1970s. Emerson Murray, where can people take a look more so about this book if they're interested? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, okay, for sure. Yep, it's a self-published book. I did it myself. It's murdercapitaloftheworld.com. I package up the books myself. I got my two daughters. We'll package them up and get them sent out to you ASAP if you order it. If you're in the Santa Cruz area, which this is a big podcast, it's in a couple of local bookstores. You can get the Kindle on Amazon, but the Kindle only has like 25 pictures. You're not going to get the same impact as the paperback. So I had a series of 1,000 printed. They're signed and numbered. I have about 150 left, and I'm going to get 500 more. That'll be a second printing. But, murdercapitaloftheworld.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Emerson Murray. Murder Capital of the World, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much. You have a great evening, and thank you for this interview.
Thank you.
Good night.